I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. Your idea of what a Shakespearean actor sounds like probably comes from the likes of Laurence Olivier.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Rather than, say, Ethan Hawke.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
Olivier just sounds more Shakespearean. But maybe, in fact, not. Maybe for the last 400 years, the pronunciation of English by English people has changed so much, it turns out we're actually missing the full flavor and the full meanings of Shakespeare's language. Anyhow, that's the theory of David and Ben Crystal, a father and son team of linguists. And Ben is also a successful Shakespearean actor. The Crystals have recreated what they say is original pronunciation, how Shakespeare's plays would have sounded around 1600. David and Ben Crystal, welcome to Studio 360.
Great to be here.
Nice to see you, Kurt.
So when did you and which of you decided to start figuring out the original pronunciation of Shakespeare?
Well, this all started, this is David, and this all started in 2004. When the telephone rings at home, and it's Shakespeare's Globe in London. And the director there, Tim Carroll, wanted to put on a production of Romeo and Juliet in original pronunciation. The Globe, you see, is known for its attempt to reconstruct original practices, you know, original music, original costume, and so on.
Right.
So that's how it started. We did a Romeo and Juliet reconstruction in OP, as we call it, original pronunciation. It was very successful. And since then, the ball has started rolling.
I remember when Dad first started speaking to me about this almost 10 years ago, and he said, you know, I think we're probably about 80% right. And then a few years later, he said, you know what, I think we're actually about 90% right.
Yes.
And he's continuing his academic work on OP and refining that even still. And then on the other side of the fork, as it were, I've gone off and have been exploring it from a practical, from a practitioner's point of view, and the effects that it has on a company, on the way that they move, on the speed of speech, and indeed the quality of Shakespeare performance that comes out of people when they use this accent.
Just so we can compare apples to apples, Ben, if you can remember it or know it, can you do that, the Hamlet soliloquy we started with?
Hamlet's to be or not to be in original pronunciation. It's the first few lines. To bear or not to bear, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sair troubles and by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished.
That's fantastic. In addition to being less portentous than any version of that I've ever heard, it sounds like most English people in 1600s spoke more like people in the north of England and Ireland do now. So essentially, the accent in the south of England was the one that modernized and became standard?
Well, that's right. The history of English accents is very interesting here. When we did this at the Globe, I spent the interval going around the audience and saying, what do you think? How do you recognize it? And everybody said, we speak like that where I come from. You know, and it didn't matter where they came from, whether they came from the north of England or Ireland or Scotland or even parts of America. They all said, we recognize that accent. And the reason, you see, is that this was the accent that led to many of these other accents. You know, the Irish and Scots and Northern and so on all developed out of it. And, of course, American accents too, because this is the accent that went across on the Mayflower, you see.
And later right. Australian.
And later Australia. Now, the received pronunciation that you heard earlier on with Laurence Olivier, this is a very late accent. It doesn't arrive in Britain, in England, until about the year 1800. It was a class accent, you mm-hmm. see, when the new class system was developing, upper class, middle class, lower class, and the upper class people wanted to make sure they didn't sound like lower class people. Then that accent evolved and became the RP that we know today. But in Shakespeare's time, there was nothing remotely like received pronunciation.
In terms of going to see a Shakespeare play, it completely turns everything on its head. So the things that you were picking up there when you heard me do Hamlet's to be or not to be, and you're saying it sounds a bit more colloquial and informal and that kind of thing. You think about the kind of theatrical dynamic that the Globe has, where the lights are on the audience and on the actors mm-hmm. as well, and you can see each other, and there's a two-way dynamic. So they talk to the audience. It's a sort of time to ask your friend for help. You know, what do you think I should do? Do you think I should kill Claudius? Do you think I should believe the ghost? And you know, the audience would reply as well. So suddenly you've got a two-way dynamic. You're much more involved with the action rather than when this more sort of clipped and polite accent came in. The lights were off on the audience. They were observers on someone self-reflecting, and thereby you get this grander sort of, pedestal style of Shakespeare.
That's interesting. So this language helped make the fourth wall non-existent until it was invented sometime in the 19th century.
One of the things you have to appreciate when you are talking about accent is that accent doesn't exist independently of the rest of the body or even the rest of the stage. One of the most noticeable things that I saw when I was sitting in the rehearsal room at Shakespeare's Globe, and next to me was sitting the mistress of movement at the Globe there, Glyn MacDonald.
What a title.
Yes. I was master of original pronunciation and she was mistress of movement. Wasn't it lovely? Anyway, we're watching the actors on the stage, and this was the first time she'd seen them since they'd learnt the accent. Now, they were already doing Romeo, you see, in the modern accent at the same time as they were doing it in OP. And she looked at me and said, they're moving differently. They're holding themselves differently. Now, the speed difference that we're talking about is quite significant. If I give you an example, when Romeo looks up at the gallery and says, "It," in modern English, "it is my lady, oh, it is my love, oh, that she knew she were," that's about 6 seconds. Now, if you do it in OP, it comes out like this. "It is my lady, oh, it is my love, oh, that she knew she were." That's about 4 seconds. Huh. Now, when you compare the OP Romeo with the modern Romeo, the OP version was 10 minutes shorter because of this speed issue. And that's a lifetime on stage, isn't it, Ben? I mean, 10 minutes shorter is amazing.
I mean, it's everything that you want from, you know, the Romeo and Juliet chorus when he says it's now the 2 hours traffic of our stage rather than the, you know, the 3 3/4 hours traffic.
It's so wonderfully counterintuitive, too, since we think, oh, now is the time of speed. And, of course, we're slower.
In a much more sort of, I suppose, in a very straightforward effect, you know, cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war. Mm-hmm. The line from Julius Caesar, you know, it's a wonderful line that, and you know, in received pronunciation, it's cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war. And you sort of think, well, you know, one of the things that you want to do when you're working with actors on Shakespeare is encourage them to bring the colour out in words. Now, how to bring the colour out in the word war? How do you make it sound like war, you know? Well, it's already there for you in original pronunciation. Cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war, you know. What do you want to, hello, I'm a dog of war. Enchanted to meet you. Or, yes. I'm a dog of war.
Yeah. The other astounding part of this is that it has apparently allowed you and us to unearth kind of archaeologically puns and jokes that were invisible to us heretofore. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is the thing. One of the questions I bet is in every listener's mind at the moment, unless they're specialists in linguistics, is how do you know? How do you know? How do you reconstruct? And the answer is very simple. You look very carefully at all the rhymes that don't work in modern English that do work in Shakespeare's day, and we can illustrate that in a second. And the next thing you do is you look at all the puns that don't work in modern English that did work in Shakespeare's day. Now, the rhymes are the first thing, before we get on to puns. Mm-hmm. The sonnets in particular, Ben,
they're supposed to rhyme, right?
They absolutely. Now, 96 of the sonnets don't rhyme perfectly, and you have to ask the question, well, why is that? Was Shakespeare not a very good poet then? Yeah.
And that's most of them, listeners, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. Out of the 154, that's a tremendous number. And the other thing is, you can't get out of it by saying, ah, well, these were I rhymes, you know, rhymes that looked right, even though they didn't sound right, because that wasn't the fashion of speaking in those days. No, the sonnets, and Ben, would you do one for us? Because that'll illustrate the point perfectly.
Sure, well, the end rhyme of 116, if this be error and upon me proved, I never writ nor no man ever loved.
Which there we are. Proved and loved.
Proved and loved.
You know, They should rhyme. Now, the question academically is it proved and loved or proved and loved? Now, there, this is where I come in. I go looking at the sources and find that, for example, Ben Jonson, the dramatist, but he also wrote an English grammar, says when he, at the beginning of his grammar, he goes through all the letters of the alphabet, and when he gets to letter O, he says, we pronounce this word short, and he gives examples like glove, prov, love. So he tells us that it's short. So the real version is, Ben?
If this be Aaron upon me proved, I never writ, no man e'er loved.
That's fantastic. Ben, you have been leading workshops in the United States and all over the United Kingdom.
And I'm about to again.
Great. How do American actors do in picking up OP versus British? Is there any difference?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, really, because, you know, Dad sort of, obviously, from an academic point of view, hates that final 10% that he can't fill.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to find a way to turn it to my advantage. So, you know, there's an element in that, you know, my original pronunciation is original pronunciation to 90%. And then that last 10% is, well, I was born near London, so this is my sort of natural spoken accent. And then I grew up in North Wales, and then I went to university in Lancaster, and then I came back down to London, so I got a bit of Cockney as well. And I spent a lot of time travelling around the world, so I got a bit of a transatlantic thing. So my original pronunciation is 90% OP, and then 10% filled with me, you know, the very essence of my sort of accent background. And so it makes me speaking Shakespeare, you know, a company who's all speaking in OP, they all sound pretty much the same, but at the same time, they have an ownership over it that, you know, is quite unlike any other. Now, when I was working with the Rena Whites on Hamlet, and I'm about to go to Houston next week to work with a company on Julius Caesar, there are parts of the accent that are more natural to them, you know, like the strong R or whatever that's very inherent to modern American.
Although not necessarily Texas.
No, well, not necessarily in Texas, but interesting,
or Boston, for that matter.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you know, the thing is, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, you think that all plays should be done in the Globe and all, you know, we should be in doublet and hose and all speak in original pronunciation. And, you know, I was working with an actor who was struggling with Oberon, and he had to do the speech, flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink in apple of his eye. And the rhymes don't work. And I said, well, you know, they do in OP. Flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink an apple of his eye. Uh-huh. Now, does that mean that, you know, forevermore we should do it in OP? No, it works brilliantly in Southern American. Flower of this purple dye, hip with Cupid's archery, sink an apple of his eye. You know, as long as you can speak it in an accent that fits, that's all that's needed, really.
Do you guys ever just joke around and talk to each other in OP? Do this dialogue from Star Wars or something? I don't know.
all the time.
Absolutely right.
And tea, you know, time in the crystals.
Yes. But this is a very important thing. When you're working with the actors, as I did at the Globe, and I think you did also in Reno, Ben, that's one of the things I tell them to do when they leave each other at the end of the evening. I tell them, don't say good night to each other. Say good night. You know, get into the habit of using your OP, ordering a pint of beer in the pub or whatever it is. Do it in OP and make it become second nature to you. Very important strategy.
Second nature.
Second nature, yes.
David and Ben Crystal, thank you so much. This was just a pleasure.
Likewise.
And ours too. Thanks, Kurt.
Ben Crystal is touring the country right now with his own Shakespeare workshop. It'll pop up in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Washington, D.C. this month. All the information is at studio360.org. And if you want to learn more about original pronunciation and maybe have a few more laughs, my full conversation with the Crystals is up at our site as well. You know what?